NPR.
Hello, 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 and welcome to the local edition on a Monday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Roballo. Thank you so much for joining me on the program. We have a special local edition tonight. Tonight, I'm airing my interview with John J. Lennon, who is an incarcerated journalist. His new book comes out tomorrow, The Tragedy of True Crime. John J. Lennon's work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Esquire, New York Times Magazine. He's been twice a finalist for the National Magazine Award. He's currently serving his 24th year at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. His book is a first-person account of a man who has killed, and he's writing about the lives of other men who have killed through their stories and his own. And it makes us sort of reconsider what we think and what we know about true crime punishment and the search for redemption. So I had the opportunity to hear from someone who was writing from both a journalistic viewpoint and a lived experience. So here's my conversation with John J. Lennon. Let's update listeners and just sort of give a brief bio on not the reasons why you're incarcerated, but where did you find the passion for writing and where did you discover writing as a talent of yours while incarcerated?
Yeah, so I guess I've always liked story, even when I was running around as a criminal in Brooklyn, and I would always get sucked up in the story. But eventually I went away for, in 2001, I killed a man, and ultimately, you know, I was sentenced 28 years to life. I had 25 to life for the murder, and I had other charges that ran consecutive. So that's how I wound up selling drugs, carrying guns. And eventually I wound up with that term of 28 years to life. And when I was in Attica, maybe in like 2010, I was fortunate to sort of land in a creative writing workshop, and it was really geared towards nonfiction, narrative writing, creative essay writing. And that's kind of like, that's where I got the writing bug. It's where it kind of showed me what good writing looked like. I was, you know, you're kind of on your own in prison. A lot of us come in, myself included, very uneducated. So, but a lot of the teaching and where I started leaning towards the genre or the style in which, you know, I really pursued was really just getting a lot of magazines, ordering a lot of magazines. In the workshop, we were sort of reading best American essay collections, and I kind of like started ordering the magazines from which those collections had reprinted essays, and I kind of went from there, and I kind of taught myself the style of first-person journalism pretty much in my cell, just reading long-form articles. So that's how it came to be in Attica, teaching myself to be a magazine journalist. And a fun fact was that they had like a bit of a stupid directive that it was really difficult to send a prisoner books because the package room guards were sort of misinterpreting a directive. It's usually like that. I think a lot of the directives in prison, the prison system are poorly written. So they had a hard time. We had a hard time receiving books. So my mother would send me magazine subscriptions, which would come with the regular mail. And it was kind of by happenstance, I became really, it's one of the factors that played into me becoming a magazine writer.
And since then, you know, you've been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Esquire, and the New York Times Magazine. You know, after publishing so many articles in all these major magazines, what made you feel that this book needed to be written, The Tragedy of True Crime?
I kind of write about things that I experience. And in 2018, I experienced, you know, CNN producers had reached out to me, and they told me that they wanted to sort of like do a redemption documentary on my life. And I was like, cool, like, let's do it. And they had just kind of misled me on the name of the show, and so I was doing this work, and I know who I was when I came to prison. I was an awful person. I'm not proud of the things I did, but that was 18 years prior to when I had spoke to these folks. So I actually believed them when they said, you know, we're really interested in how you turned your life around. But it turned out to be they lied to me about the name of the show, and when the show aired, it was, I mean, they did capture who I'd become, but it was majority of a recounting and reenactments of my crime. It was very hard to watch. I wound up watching it on a TV in my cell. Others were watching it, and it really hit me to this whole genre of true crime that was happening at the same time. Really, criminal justice coverage was happening, and I was like, what is going on here? How do I wind up on a show called Inside Evil 18 years after my crime? And when my crime, was fresh, it wasn't even a second thought for the media. They didn't even cover it. It was a couple of tabloid articles, but I was like, so what's happening? So I really became intrigued about true crime, and I started writing critical articles, and eventually, I was critiquing, the true crime industry on the one hand, and then on the other hand, I was like, maybe I could do it better. Maybe I could tell fuller stories about my fears. And so that's kind of how the book came about.
And you are following other folks who are incarcerated with you, and you have, obviously a unique perspective because it's a first person account. You're writing about the lives of other men who also have killed through, your stories and their own stories. Now, in reporting, you weave your story and the stories of other men who have killed. What has been sort of the hardest part of balancing your own stories with theirs?
I mean, it's finding a way to sort of relate to them. I don't know. It's finding a way where I can enter the narrative where it's furthering our story. So I think a first person journalist really has to think twice about when they're writing about others, how much their story is necessary to tell these other stories. Fortunately for a lot of journalists, they don't carry the weight that I carry, which is also having killed the man, my subjects, not all of them killed men. But I mean, the point is I carry something different than most journalists. So it's, hold on a second. Just want to mute this for a second. The TA is right next to my desk. Sorry about that. That's a little texture in the background for the listeners. So New York State prisoners have tablet phones, which is a little easier. The previous interviews we did, when I was in another prison, I would be in the yard. It's a little bit more convenient, but the background music sometimes is, or the background atmospheric sort of noises, it can be a bit much sometimes. I have a PA speaker right by my cell. But yeah, just to finish up on that question, it was about sort of when my story was needed in the narrative to sort of maybe illuminate some of the some of the issues around other stories and how can I relate to the person I'm writing about. So if it was, I don't know if that was the hard part, but it's always hard knowing like where our to sort of transition your own story into the stories of those you write about.
You just mentioned it a little while ago, you being incarcerated and this sort of boom in true crime. And I think the book challenges the way true crime is usually told. What do you think gets lost when the public assumes crime as entertainment?
Well, what gets lost is what happens to the person who committed the crime after the judgment, after the sentence. They go away, but there is this whole other part of the story that unfolds. Milton Jones, one of my characters in the story, he was 17 years old. He suffered from some disabilities growing up, intellectual disabilities. He grew up in a poor neighborhood in the 80s, and a young black man, and he struggled. And I think, after he committed his crime, he went away. And so at 17 years old, to when I meet him at 50 years old, so he committed his crime in 1987, right? So I meet him when he's 50 years old, pursuing a master's degree in theology. And Milton is in, at 17 years old, he participated in a double murder of two priests with another teenager. But I think when we looked him up, even before I wrote about him, there's a huge gap in his story from 17 to 50. And it's a pretty inaccessible gap. That's what's really all the guys I write about. I would say that this applies to Michael Shane Hale, who in 1995, at 23, killed his 63-year-old mother. there was a toxic relationship. And when he went away, you know, I meet him when he's many years later in 2017, I meet him for the first time. So there's a lot of this like inaccessible space. And it's the same with Robert Chambers. I think whenever, you know, he's probably the most sort of infamous character, true crime celebrity, although I'm sure he doesn't appreciate that title. When we think of, he's had to sort of live with monikers like the Preppy Killer and all this kind of stuff. What's that feel like? What's that look like when at 18 years old, you kill a girl in the park and you become this iconic true crime figure? And then what does his whole life look like? What's it like to be sort of, to be serving time in prison and to have all these narratives about you? So, I mean, I just thought each of the characters, there was a part of their story that was untold. And if you're asking me what true crime is missing, I would say in large part is that.
Yeah, and talking about Shane, you know, reading his story, when you write about Shane's background, it really highlights the trauma and circumstances that sort of shaped his path to where he is now, or leading up to when he got incarcerated. Do you think the public underestimates the role of environment in violent crime?
The environment's about how you're growing up and how your environment.
Yeah, because if you look at Shane's story and the abuse that he faced as a young boy, and him being a gay man and struggling with the identity, when I was reading it, it almost sort of like, I'll be honest with you, it sort of broke my heart that this person had to go through all of this. And it makes you wonder automatically, maybe this is naive of me, but it makes you wonder automatically that, wow, if there's only was a person who may have stepped in and helped Shane through his time, maybe he wouldn't have ended up incarcerated. But you know, when you bring his background into it, it's almost, you can see how it sort of shaped him to where he was, to the point where he gets incarcerated. Do you feel that sort of the public sort of underestimates that the role of someone's upbringing and the environment they're in can lead to a violent crime life?
Sure. I mean, you know, look, I think, you know, those are what's called in legal terms, mitigating factors, mitigation, like what drove him to this point? Like what was his life like up until the point that he killed Stefan, which is the name of, you know, his lover at the time. And yeah, I mean, I think in his situation, in terms of a societal sort of, I mean, he grew up in Kentucky, a young man who's gay. And that's very difficult in the 70s, growing up in Kentucky, really anywhere. But eventually he's sort of at 19 years old, he sort of rises to New York City and, you know, with all that grief and all that rejection, he wants to find his people. And, you know, what happens is he continues to be used as, you know, sort of fresh face, the looking boy who has no means, and he continues to be sort of taken advantage of, even though sometimes prostitutes made it look like he was taking advantage of others, but he wasn't like some robust sex worker. He was trying to get by. I would say, you know, all of our backstories are quite relevant to where we are in that moment in time that we make that decision. I think it's a little, you know, so it's the rejection of the world, we reject him, Shane. And there's a lot of anger in that. With Milton, I think there was intellectual sort of disabilities and just growing up in a very poor, difficult neighborhood. I mean, he saw violence, you know, in his household when he was younger with his uncles, and sort of fleshed that out with Milton. I mean, it was a very positive community, and I think what throws people a curve is, you know, Robert Chambers' crime. And I try to do that on purpose. They're not all sort of, you know, suffering from the awful backstory. I think that's a lot of the reason why people resent Robert Chambers, is because he did not have the awful backstory. But there was a societal time in the 80s growing up in Manhattan where young kids were on the Upper East Side, where they weren't really affected by the gang wars from the 80s and Harlem and the Lower East Side and all these sort of wild neighborhoods. But he was in a safe Upper East Side. And when he killed Jennifer Levin in the park, you know, he was a very good-looking young man. And people didn't really couldn't answer that question that you're asking. Like, what are the factors in people dismiss those. And that's kind of like, you know, why this case was head scratching. I like to think I explore some of that in the book. And with my case, and mine is more traditional. I also grew up in very seedy neighborhoods in Hell's Kitchen. And I was very captivated by gangsters, you know, father figure. I relate to Milton a lot with that. So, you know, so all that sort of plays a part. I think it should be offered for context, not sort of to rationalize our crimes. But I think to get the full story, I think you should drop back and sort of learn how somebody grows up. And that's why I try to structure the book the way I do. I meet them in prison, and through that meeting in current time, I drop back and tell the stories of their lives. And then we get to the crime. And, you know, I sort of weave my own crime through some of theirs when I get to that crime stage. And I try to unpack that, what we were thinking. You can't, nonfiction, right? You can't really crawl into somebody's head. But you, when you share the same experience, unfortunately, you can offer what's in your head. So that's why, that's another sort of reason of how I render my own experiences alongside my subjects.
You're listening to The Local Edition on a Monday evening. My name is Patricio Robayo. I'm talking to incarcerated journalist John J. Lennon about his new book, Tragedy of a True Crime. We'll be right back with more.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
He did not hate his opponents. He wanted the best for them. That's where I disagreed with Charlie. I hate my opponent. And I don't want the best for them. I'm sorry.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Welcome back to The Local Edition on a Monday evening. I'm your host, Patricio Robayo. We are continuing my conversation with incarcerated journalist John J. Lennon, whose new book is out tomorrow, Tragedy of a True Crime. I continue to talk to John about the flow and the structure of his book and how we are sort of a fly on the wall as he meets his fellow incarcerated, as he meets the other incarcerated people in the book and learns about their story. I tell him it feels organic and it feels like you were right there with him.
With any narrative writer, I mean, you know, structure is very important. Like, where are we going to start the story? I think typical true crime stories, I think we all know, and all the listeners know too. It's like when you watch in terms of structure, when you watch a show about murder like that, it usually starts in medias res, they call it, a storyteller, which is like right up before everything unravels, right? It's this crescendo moment in the story. And it's usually the murder. You hear 911 calls, you hear action, you may hear some gunshots. I mean, it's frankly, you know, pretty cheesy. You know, you see one street front, but you've seen them all. But, obviously I didn't want to do that. I wanted to make it authentic, but also gritty, too. I'm not shying away from what we did. And we'll get to that. It's a slow burn to that. And, I think there's intention with the way people structure their stories, and that's the sort of beef that I do have with traditional true crime. It's just like, dude, to what end are you telling the story generations later? And then you're just like opening this story, and then now it's fresh in the minds of people that hadn't even known about this. Like for example, like Robert Chambers' story. Like I remembered his case back when it happened. I was very young, but it was sensational. It was all over. It was like the OJ of the time in the 80s. It was like one of those big, it was probably the first case like that. But I remember I'd seen it in 2020 before I had transferred to a prison and was to meet him. And I was actually interviewing Milton at the time. And I came up and my neighbor, I think, told me like, there's a docuseries on about Robert Chambers. And I was like, wow, that was like 33 years ago. Like, why is there a, a multi-night docuseries about this guy's hunt. And he was in prison. And I was like, Matt, I wonder what that's like for him to have the whole cell block watching his life. And I would find out, because right after that, I would transfer and land with him. And I explain that in the book. So there's these little things that happen. There's things like that my access allows me to sort of tell these stories of that what happens to my peers. And when you set those scenes, look, you know, whenever people do the things that we did, it's very difficult to sort of like render folks as sympathetic characters, right? But when you tell the full story and you explain these things that people probably wouldn't even think of, I think if people are giving it a fair read, they'd be like, wow, that's not cool. That's pretty awful, I would like to think. And so that's what, yeah. That's what I did with Rod. It was a risky character story. I think necessary.
Yeah. Well, let's bring listeners to on how you write it while incarcerated. You know, you're writing, I mean, in the past you mentioned that sometimes it was as handwritten notes, but a lot of times is tapping on your tablet, these stories.
Well, I mean, like any journalist, I'm going to have, well, I wouldn't say any journalist, but I don't have like tape recorder or anything like that. So usually I'm a little spoiled with my characters. Oftentimes I live with them, my subjects. And so I get to observe them when sometimes they don't even know. We live with each other. So with Rob, for example, with Shane, with Milk, and all my characters, I spend time with them. I see how they treat others. I see how others treat them. And that's kind of an edge that other journalists don't have, right? Even journalists, when you're going, it's immersive, right? You're living with the person. It's not always like, all right, let's sit down. Let me whip my pad out and tell me about your younger, more vulnerable years. It's a little more fluid than that. And in fact, I try not to like whip out my pad in the yard it's a little uncomfortable, right, to do that and to like a lot. My style is like a lot of. Like Gabe Reese he's a famous Esquire writer. You observe a lot when I'm sort of talking to a subject. Sometimes I'm just talking to them. Maybe when they like, maybe I'll write a few things down that I know I have to capture that like quote, you know, jot it down real quick. And you try not to sort of like have the pad open. It's kind of like hanging out style of journalism, very magazine style of lead journalism. And then later on, I would go in my cell and sort of type up the notes and, you know, try to be a little organized about my interviews. But a lot of stuff was observation, too. But yeah, when we got the technology in prison, I got the book deal in 2021, but we got these tablets and stuff, and it was really helpful. Before that, I worked on a typewriter with a very limited memory. You know, a lot of dictating for magazine pieces. People who would help me on the outside. Now it's mostly my publicist, Megan Posto. I work with, you know, with a lot of my, my book publishers, but we work on a lot of freelance artists together. You kind of need, but that's the process. Kind of need folks on the outside to develop relationships, professional relationships. The process is quite a tricky one. But yeah, the technology certainly enabled me to, I mean, I wrote the book and much of the book in draft as I explained the author's process. And the draft section of this tablet, they had these like rubber keyboards that you could plug in and that you could buy from the company, this prison communications company, which is pretty controversial because they charge us for things. But like it has enabled me to send emails. I mean, all this stuff is scrutinized. All this, it's very difficult. Sometimes I actually don't go there, but. It beats the blank. It beats dictating over the phone when you're on deadline. It beats, so, you know, I'll take it. But yeah, I mean, the new technology in prison. I mean, I never thought when I came to prison 24 years ago that I'd be on the phone right now in my cell, because there's a phone function on the tablet too. Most recently, they put that on last year. So I never thought I'd be doing like an interview in my cell right now talking to you, but I am. So the technology has helped.
How do you want people to think differently about the men who commit crimes or sometimes violent crimes after reading your book?
Well, as you say, one of your questions suggests, I mean, like, you know, trying to get the fuller story. I mean, I think I think when folks read the book, I mean, they're going to see that there's a lot that happens before and after the gun that kind of offer more of a credible picture of who these guys are. So, I mean, I would hope they readers give us a fair shake and sort of come away from this, you know, with a bit of a different feeling maybe than they come away from, you know, traditional food. When we think of story, we think of, you know, sympathetic character trying to overcome a complicated situation that he has resolved, right? But man, it's tough for us all to be sympathetic characters that you all root for. And that's the tricky thing about writing about guilty people. And I don't write about the innocent, people that say they're innocent. I write about the guilt. And I think that I hope that there's some kind of appreciation with some readers that see folks like myself and Milkin and Shane and even Rob, understanding, you know, how they carry what they did and how they come to terms with that or don't. Not everyone can express, you know, remorse in a crystallized way, perhaps even myself. But I hope, you know, I just would hope there's some, you know, sort of just understanding and give us, you know, a bit more of a fair shake than when our stories are rendered in these other outlets. I mean, if anything, I think that's what any storyteller would want, just to evoke empathy. I think the world could use a bit more empathy these days, especially this nation.
Yeah, sir, definitely. So, John, is there anything I haven't touched on that you want folks to know about your book?
Yeah, it's September 23rd. I guess, I'm told, you can order it anywhere, The Tragedy of True Crime. And I hope folks buy it and engage with it. Yeah. Just thank you. Thank you for your... always thank you, WJFS, and all you listeners. I appreciate you. You've been very kind to me over the years in terms of your interest. So it's been fun. So thanks.
Well, you know, The Tragedy of True Crime for Four Guilty Men and the stories that define us, like John said, is out on September 23rd. You can find that book anywhere you find books. And not only that, one thing I didn't talk about, I found out there is also an audio book that will be released with it.
I got to listen to a little bit of it. Megan had played it to me, my publisher. She had played it to me over the phone. I mean, this guy is amazing. I don't engage with books that way, but for folks who do, I mean, he nailed it. Like, just in terms of, it's so sort of captivating just to listen. And a little unusual to listen to your own words read back, but I got a little dose of it, and if that's your thing, Celadon, the publisher, hired this guy, and he's really the best of your business, so really grateful for him and for the audio book. Yeah, that's your thing. It's definitely out there. Tragedy of True Crime is on audio. Grab the book wherever.
Yes, definitely. So, yeah, John, again, thank you for sharing your work. And sharing your experiences and perspectives with me again today. I do really appreciate it, as always. Thank you so much. You can hear more of this conversation on our website and YouTube page. Just search for WJFF Radio Catskill. The Tragedy of True Crime, Four Guilty Men, and the Stories That Define Us. The new book by John J. Lennon is out on Tuesday, September 23rd. And is out on Celadon Books. Again, thank you to John J. Lennon, my guest. And thank you to you for joining us on a Monday evening on The Local Edition. We'll be back tomorrow starting at 6 with a guest host, Genevieve Hartman, one of our new reporters. Again, you are listening to The Local Edition. I've been your host, Patricio Roballo. Lucy, have a good night. Everyone else, take care of yourself.
Thank you. Every weekday morning at 9, NewsHour from the BBC brings you the most important international news stories. NewsHour helps you understand a complex world. Stay informed with NewsHour from the BBC, weekday mornings at 9 on Radio Catskill.